You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 573. So what can you do to protect yourself? You can shock people. Andrew Kevin Walker.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Today's show is also sponsored by Frameset. I don't know about you guys, but as a director, I'm always looking for ways to show my crew, my cast, what I'm thinking about angles, about theme, about lighting, about concepts. And I used to always have to go and get stills from movies and have to do them manually. And it was just a hassle. But now we have Frameset. Now, Frameset is a search engine for movie, music videos, and commercial frames. You can search by the name of the movie, by color, by theme, by tone, by angle. There's so many things you can search by. It is a fantastic resource for filmmakers. So just head over to frameset.app and use the coupon code NM22 for 25% off. That's frameset.app. Now, guys, today on the show, we have a very entertaining guest, to say the least. We have writer-producer Brian Nelson. Now, Brian, you may know from his work writing the cult classic Sundance Darling from 2005, Hard Candy, and he also wrote an amazing adaptation of 30 Days of Night, arguably one of the best vampire scripts ever written, in my opinion. He also worked with M. Night Shyamalan on the film Devil, and he is a co-executive producer of the series Altered Carbon and many, many, many other projects, including his new narrative podcast, which we will go into in the conversation. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Brian Nelson. I'd like to welcome the show, Brian Nelson. How are you doing, Brian?
So far, so good.
We have been talking for, I don't know, 20 minutes before we even got started. So I have a good feeling about this conversation. I think we're going to have a lively, you know, trip down the rabbit hole of screenwriting and the craft and a few other surprises, I'm sure. So before we get started, how did you get, first of all, why and how did you get started in this business? Like, this is a ridiculous business.
Why would anyone get started
in this business? This is an insane business. Like, you know, it's insane. How did you get started?
I had the fortune not to know how insane it would be before I entered.
Fair enough.
You know, long version or short version, which would you like?
Whichever you would like to. Whichever you feel like you like. So we're going to be here for a minute.
Let me dig my own grave.
Exactly.
All right. For various reasons that are part of the long version, I had this notion that, oh, maybe I'll try to like work a number of different jobs over my life. So I worked for a little while as a high school teacher, and I worked for a little while as a theater director. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to move into writing. And of course, once I moved into writing, that means working a new job all the time. So I didn't have to actually continue that model because I was constantly as a writer, you are, you know, reinventing yourself all the time, and you are taking on new territory and responsibilities all the time. 10 years ago, I had to learn everything there was to learn about Florence and the Italian Renaissance for Da Vinci's Demons. A little later, I had to learn everything there was to. I read every word we still have written by Lee Harvey Oswald, because I was doing a deep dive into the Kennedy assassination for 11/22/63. So that is part of it, was that I had this sort of sweet idealistic notion of, oh, let's just live a life where you're constantly reinventing yourself. And then I stumbled upon this career where I'm, in fact, already constantly reinventing myself. So be careful what you wish for. You know, having said that, I mean, I've always on some level, you know, I was that kid in first grade. I was writing little episodic stories, like,
wow.
Yeah, I know. I stumbled upon this one day and I was like, I did this? But yes, here's, like, in my little first grade handwriting, there's chapter 5, where there's like a team of like sort of a Mission Impossible type operatives, and they all kind of happened to be my friends, but they all had code names, and I was X5, who was secretly the robot. Which, what does that say about my like self-image and you know, my, we'll leave that for later. At any rate, so I've always, you know, since my earliest memories, been, sometimes despite myself, I've been a storyteller, and to get like a little more thoughtful about it, you know, I think that on some level, that's our job as humans, is to take a universe that seems without reason frequently and figure out the reasons, make things make sense. You know, that's our gift as humans, is to be able to interpret a possibly meaningless reality and ascribe meaning to it and make sense of our lives that way. So I figured out somehow within all that how to actually make a living doing the thing that I think humans should be doing anyway. So far so good.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think it's for a writer, I think it is our responsibilities to be able to give some sort of meaning to this insanity that we are just our life and why we're here and what's going on, and doing these deep dives, especially, you know, going, you know, doing research on your career. And you just mentioned a couple, like the, you know, the Renaissance and the Kennedy assassination, and there's a couple of vampires in there, and there's a devil in there as well. There's a few other things that you've really delved into a lot of things, but as storytellers, you're absolutely right. It is our job to kind of do that in an entertaining fashion, because that's what we were doing around the campfire, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 years ago. It's, you know, and stories, I always tell people, stories are, they saved your life, because if you didn't tell the story about the tiger who ate that guy around the corner down by the river, if that story didn't get out, the tiger would still be eating people left and right.
Well put. And, you know, I have a friend who told me once, like, I actually get into that whole campfire thing when I'm pitching a story to executives. Like, I channel all of like the 1930s radio drama energy that I can.
Yes.
My friend says, yes, Brian, you have this, what he calls this, your dark campfire mojo, where you're telling this story and you're making it clear that, like, if people don't listen, something terrible might happen. So, yeah.
Your best Orson Welles. Your best Orson Welles at this point.
Not the first time that that analogy has come up in my life. It's true.
Now, you did a movie called Hard Candy back in 2005. I remember when it came out. And it was very risque for its time. I remember people were like, what? Like they were really, and it really caught a lot of fire. How did you get from the script to production to Sundance and then you know, finally getting it distributed?
I mean, Hard Candy was a tremendous experience for me. I had been working as a writer for a little over 10 years, where I'd been in a writer's room on a series. I'd written a miniseries. I'd done various freelance gigs, but also I was like trying to figure out how to like let things catch fire. And honestly, I had no idea that Hard Candy would be the thing that caught fire. But a producer named David Higgins had read a play of mine and had said, let's figure something out. And he had a sort of clever idea. He was at the time a development executive himself who wanted to move into producing. And his thought was, I'm going to sort of see if I could come up with like logline sentences for movies that could be made for like $15 and find writers and develop them that way. And so we kicked various ideas around. And one day he said, you know, there's this story that I read about in Japan where these underage teenage girls would lure businessmen up to their apartment with the promise of illicit, dangerous sex, and then beat them up and rob them. And we talked about, like, it's really interesting, this dynamic of you start the story thinking, oh, I should be afraid for this person. And then you realize, except maybe I should be afraid of them. And right. That was, felt like a juicy dynamic to consider. And so we kept talking. I shaped out really a shockingly minuscule treatment. I think it was like maybe four and a half pages. Mm-hmm. And David managed to say, you know, I think we got something here, but of course, I have no money, but if you thought about speccing it, I bet we could sell it. And it happened to be New Year's. And so I was like, well, resolutions, fresh start, sure. Let's see what happens if I give 2 or 3 days a week to just seeing what happens if I move forward with this story, which at this point on the treatment was called Vendetta. Very lame.
Very 80s B movie.
Yeah. Very true. Had to call it something. And fast forward on the title theme, when we eventually were in production, we were like, well, we need a new title. I pitched for a while the idea of let's call it Snip Snip. And
amazing.
That always gets a reaction, but Higgins, to his credit, thought maybe not the reaction.
A little too far.
And so he said, you know, there's that movie where like the cheerleaders rob the bank, where it's called Sugar and Spice. And
right.
Maybe there's something in that vein where we talk about like that dynamic. And so along those terms, I pitched Hard Candy and as the title, and that's what it became. So I'd written the script. The script wrote remarkably fast. It just felt like I'm onto something here. It was one of those situations where, like, you know, you set a certain quota for yourself of how many pages you want to try to draft a day.
And sure.
Routinely, I was like exceeding my quota and like hitting dinner time and going, I could keep going. Maybe I should stop now while I still know what the next lines will be. I mean, it was just, it felt very fluid. I was at the right point, I think, in my life and career to like channel a lot of different influences. And it came also partly out of my theater experience. I had trained as a director in theater. Higgins's plan B was if we never get any money to make this, then, you know, Brian, you know, actors, we could just, you know, max out our credit cards and rent a digital video camera and shoot it in my house. And so while I was writing, I was actually had in the back of my mind, write things that could shoot in David's house. You know, I was sort of choreographing it as sure. I was writing it.
Sure.
You know, like a stage director thinking, all right, now we should move to the kitchen. Or, and in fact, one day I got a ladder and I walked up on the roof of David's house.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, to see what that would feel like. David lived in a house also at that time that had a little interior rock garden with that we were like, there could be a safe under there and so forth. So I wrote it in a way for production, which I think was
smart,
something that helped.
Yeah.
We sent the script around. We got a lot of great response. We got people who were like, people from studios who were like, this is so great. Don't send it to us because we'll only screw it up. You know,
it's just what you want to hear.
It's a fascinating response. And I mean, on some level, they weren't wrong that they were like, you know, they were basically saying, no, if you do it here, then like the development process will bleed everything special out of it. And it will turn out to be not a movie where, you know, this young kid executes this diabolical revenge, but she'll turn out to be Holly Hunter pretending to be a young kid or whatever, you know.
But isn't it amazing though? Hollywood has, I've never found another industry or another place where Hollywood, other than Hollywood, that they give you the nicest FUs I've ever heard. I mean, it's artistic. Well, it's art, and that one's.
That is, I agree with you. Although in this case, I prefer not to think of it as an.
No,
prefer,
it was a little bit of it.
Exactly wise, you know.
Sure.
Counsel. So we started looking into how to make this independently, and Higgins thought, you know, if we find a director ourselves that we like, then we could present ourselves as a package. And frankly, a great aspect of this as well was that then the director's relationship would be with us, because it turns out that your biggest loyalty is often to the people that you saw as bringing you into the project. And so having that bond with a director that way was tremendous for us. So we looked at reels of various people, and you know, one of 17 incredibly lucky things that happened on this project was we ran across the work of David Slade, who had been directing commercials and music videos, but had not done a feature, was looking to do his first feature. And, you know, we like very quickly realized, oh, my God, here's someone who could, as you see in Hard Candy, he could take a teenager looking through a file cabinet and make it look like the Bourne Identity, you know?
That's what commercial and music video directors have. They have that eye.
He knows how to shoot the hell out of something. And so we became this package. I will refer to them by their last names a lot since they're both David. But we became this package of me and Higgins and Slade. And we looked to various indie funders. There was one group that actually offered us twice the money we made it for, but their deal was, but you'll have to like make it with our people. And Slade had very strong feelings about, no, if I'm going to make this for a price, it has to be my team that I know,
sure,
that I already have shorthand with, that I can work with instantly. And so we were funded by Vulcan Productions, which was Paul Allen's company. And they basically wrote us a check for $1 million, which was a lot and not much at all. and we hired an ingenious line producer whose job was to lie to us and tell us there was not much money left.
Right.
And, you know, if we kept coming at him, he would eventually say, well, I did squirrel away some money in this department.
Yes. I love line producers who do that. They're like, well, you know, I hid a little bit of money in design. So you can pull that out there. Oh, in props, I threw a couple extra grand over there.
Right,
you could grant.
Right.
Oh, it's the best.
And And so I'm going to try to angle my camera here.
Yes.
This, if you can see it.
Yes.
Wait.
Oh, it's an amazing poster. That's an amazing poster. Yes.
That is, this is a kind of collector's item. This is the poster that we made ourselves to take to Sundance.
Amazing. Amazing design. Amazing design.
You know, equally amazing was the Lionsgate design when Lionsgate eventually picked us up.
Oh, yeah.
They made that design of Haley in the hoodie standing in that giant bear trap.
Oh,
unbelievable design. I have that framed elsewhere. But this particular poster is always special to me because it was seen only by, you know, 190 people at Sundance.
So I'll tell you what. In 2005, did you guys go into, it was the Sundance 2005 Sundance, right?
Yes.
That was my first year at Sundance. And I remember walking Main Street, and I remember seeing the poster. And I remember hearing about it. And we were there promoting our short film. And it was just like, man, that's a great idea. And I just like, and the marketing for that looks really cool. And it was just, you know, for people, Sundance was a whole lot different in 2005 than it is today. It's just a whole other, it hasn't turned into what it is today. But I do remember 05, and I remember walking the streets, and I remember seeing the poster, and I remember hearing about that movie. So, yeah.
It felt like a lot today, a lot in 2005 even. I mean, it was the place was jammed, and you know, Sundance is also, I will take a moment to say, you know, wonderful in many ways and helped launch us, and at the same time, boy, they are focused on directors. So, like, you know, the artistic
not so much director, on the writer, not so much the writers.
No, the artistic director introduced the film as written and directed by David Slade, and David had to say, actually, yeah. And Sundance had not made a badge for me. But I tell that not to shame Sundance. Well, no.
A little bit.
But actually, not having a badge turned out to be great because they were like, well, we have a badge with the name of your film. So I walked around town all week and my badge said I was Hard Candy. And don't take that the wrong way. But I'd be on a bus and people would see my badge and they'd go, oh my God, I love that film. And you know, whereas had I been wearing a badge that said Brian Nelson, I just, you know, nobody would have talked to me. But really? I actually was wearing my own PR. And
brilliant.
That turned, you know, to be honest, you know, if I'm at Sundance again, I probably want to do the same strategy and not have a badge, but just have a badge with the name of my film, because that was magic.
Oh my God, that must have been an amazing experience. And then it goes on to do, you know, well. It got picked up and it does well. It's critically acclaimed. So now how does the town treat you? Because you've been around for a few years. You're not, you know, you didn't just show up with your first spec script. You'd been writing.
It's interesting because, you know, I got about 3 years later, my previous agent left the business and I signed with new agents. And when I'd see their resume that they'd send out on me, it began with Hard Candy. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. For you guys, I didn't really exist before then. Okay. All right, that's fine. But, you know, the fun thing about going on meetings in the wake of Hard Candy was that people read it. And they'd tell me all their experiences of reading it. They'd say, it was like Sunday at 11:30 at night, and I was tired. I thought, I'll burn off one more script. This looks fun. It has candy in the name. And then I'm like 20 pages in, and I'm like, what am I reading at this hour of the night? Right. And why am I all alone and not very dressed? I should put on more clothes. And so people loved telling me those stories.
Oh, that's awesome.
But also, I'd walk in and people would meet what you're seeing now. People would meet a guy who looks and sounds like me.
Right.
And they'd go, you're not who I thought.
What did they think?
It was hard candy, so they expected Marilyn Manson.
I was about to say, like, what, some emo kid to walk in?
Yeah, no, they thought that I, yeah, exactly. And you know, so I walk in, and I'm a mensch, and I'm amusing, and I,
right.
you know, come in with a kind of a light touch, and I'm easy to talk to, and I'm not, like, glaring at them, like, right. why? Right. Do you think you have the right to exist in this earth? No. So that was, but maybe that was surprisingly comforting to people that, oh, we don't have to be scared of this guy after all.
Now, so after you made your rounds in town, you and David Slade worked on another project shortly thereafter, a little vampire film, independent vampire film that we call 30 Days of Night, which is a fantastic. I mean, I love that movie, and I love the way it was shot. I love the way it was written. How did you approach adapting? It was a graphic novel, if I'm not mistaken, right?
It was a graphic novel. Yeah. It was a graphic novel created by the amazing Steve Niles.
Yeah.
With art by the equally stunning Ben Temple Smith.
Yeah, stunning stuff.
And, you know, it had been a sensation in comics. I'm one of those guys who, you know, knows way too much about comics for someone my age. You know, here's this wall you see behind me with, like, Shakespeare and Pinter, but literally on the other side of this wall
comic books
are 29,000 Marvel and DC comic books. And so,
oh, well, we can geek out then.
Yeah, just fair warning. Anyway, so I certainly knew of the project. It had been through several writers, and the studio had reached a point where they had said, we're not sure what to do with this. Maybe we hire a director, and then the director sort of supervises a writer. And yet, this is studio thinking for you. Then they were like, but maybe we shouldn't hire the writer that the director wanted, because then the writer won't listen to us. They'll only listen to the director, which, you know, having heard my, you know, thesis about who hires you is who you're loyal to. I mean, that certainly makes sense. Mm-hmm. So therefore, even though Slade wanted to bring me in on this, I still actually had to, like, enter a derby for this. I was one of three writers pitching it. I have never pitched to more people at once. 11 people include on the pitch, including two on the phone, from the studio and two production companies and the publisher of the graphic novel.
Yeah.
And so it was a lot, but somehow, luckily, I won through. And it was tremendous fun to write.
I can imagine. You
know, and look, Steve Niles had this brilliant premise for a story. So, like, the first 20 pages, like, we're already home. And he had a brilliant ending. The challenge of various writers along the way was that, there was not much in the way of character arc yet, or a second act. And so that's a lot of what I brought to that. But it was an interesting case because also, you know, Josh Hartnett,
mm-hmm.
Had been cast and won as part of his deal the right to, like, consult on script. And you know, we were, like, holding our breath about, oh, what's this actor going to say? But Josh brought interesting ideas to it. Josh said, this is a small thing, for example. It's hardly, like, when people list the things they love about 30 Days of Night, nobody says, oh, and his inhaler. But actually, you know, Josh was like, I want to be an ordinary guy. I don't want to be a secret superhero. And so, like, could we just, you know, give me like a little asthma issue and so forth, so that like when I run around a corner, we're not going to do the scene of like, must get inhaler.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, it would be great if I just had to take a moment every once in a while and just puff, you know, I just need a little help. I'm human. I'm an ordinary guy.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That was an example of something that Josh suggested that I thought would be great. Josh also suggested, what if I have like a little brother? Because the little brother was not in the graphic novel. And Josh suggested, you know, if I had a little brother, then that would be go to like the themes of family in the story. And when I thought about that, I thought, oh, this would be great, because if his brother is like 17, 19, he is like, Josh is the sheriff. Josh plays Evan. Evan's good at his job. You know, so Evan didn't have technical challenges of, can I really do this? You know, he steps up to the moment. But his little brother is his little brother. And so, like, having to watch his little brother have this coming of age where it's like, oh, my God, I just killed a vampire. Maybe I need to go throw up now. You know, that was a tremendous dynamic to have. And you know, watching that character have that little arc. Again, not something that a lot of people, when they list things about the movie, nobody ever says to me, oh, the little brother. But it was part of the texture of that story,
right,
that actually made it so human and so rich. And that, to me, in everything I write, I'm looking for that humanity. I will often say to people that regardless of what genre I'm writing, I write about people who find themselves someplace where the rules have changed. And now suddenly it's up to them to decide, whoa, what are the new rules going to be? And when they make those decisions about what's going to be right and wrong in this new paradigm, what do they discover about themselves that maybe they didn't want to know? So that's what I love, is taking people, putting them in a gray area where they have to make those hard choices, look in the mirror and go, wow, that's who I am. What the hell do I do with that? And that is Hard Candy. And that is 30 Days of Night. And that is Altered Carbon. And that is Agent Stoker. You know, even though I write in various genres and have a sort of complicated resume, that's my sort of unified field theory of what I write.
And that's a really great point of view, because I've never heard it illustrated that way before. Because, you know, obviously the ordinary world, and you go into the, you know, the new world, and that's the concept of that. But putting them in a place where the rules of their environment have changed, like in Devil, or like in 30 Days a Night, where you where, I mean, obviously, you know, you've got vampires and then the sun's never coming. Like, that's such a wonderful concept for a vampire movie. It's like, if you're going to do a vampire movie, it's such a great thing. But that, and then also, I just love the idea of the vulnerability of Josh's character, not only because of the inhaler, which is a brilliant move, brilliant, brilliant idea, but having the brother and having to watch his brother's back as well gives him another vulnerability. He's like, he's not only dealing with asthma, he's not only dealing with a town full of vampires, he's also got to watch his little brother's back and take care of him, as opposed to, so it's just all those little parts of the tapestry add so much to the character. You're absolutely right. But I love that idea of the throwing them in a gray area where the rules have changed, and see what they do when you apply this new paradigm to them.
I mean, that, you know, my feeling is sometimes the gray area happens for various reasons. Sometimes it's thrust in upon you without your being prepared for it or having asked for it. Other times you semi-wittingly or unwittingly created it because you were pursuing something. And then guess what? It's put you now in this new territory.
Right.
You know, you be careful what you ask for kind of situation.
Like,
so people could find themselves in the new paradigm for different reasons. But, you know, on some level, I'll even say that that's, you know, that is me as a screenwriter, that I was a guy who was like teaching school and directing theater. And then I entered screenwriting. And it's like, whoa, the rules are different here, and I have a lot to learn. Even though I thought I was pretty smart, man, there's still a lot to learn.
And
so,
and the game change, and the game changes almost weekly.
And I'm always asking myself, "Am I capable of what? Am I capable of? Whoa, I surprise, I didn't know I could write that, but I guess I just did." So yes, exactly. And it's fun.
Let me ask you. So I always love asking writers this about the flow, about being able to tap into their creative well. I believe that we all have a creative well. I think Spielberg said it best. He's like, ideas float in the universe and they'll come to you. And if you don't do something with that idea, it will go to somebody else. That's why he's like, oh, I had that idea, but I didn't do anything with it. And like 6 months later, oh, it's in production. Damn it. I have a great Prince story, if you want to hear a Prince story about
sure.
that. So Prince, I was
Prince
watching.
Prince is another Nelson. So, you know, I'm yes. I'm automatically in sympathy.
So Prince, the late great Prince, called up his, you know, he has like 8,000 songs. He's got a new album up into the year 3000. So a new album every year up until the year 3000, we will Believe continue it. To have Prince. So he would just call up his backup singers and his musicians at whatever time, whenever he got struck with inspiration. And one night he calls up his backups, one of the backup singers, and says, "Hey, what are you doing?" He goes, "I'm sleeping, Prince. It's 3 o'clock in the morning." He's like, "I need you to come down to the recording studio. We're going to record." He's like, "Why can you just wait like for 4 hours?" It's like, "No, I've got to get it now, and I got to get it recorded now, because if I don't, Michael Jackson's going to get it." And that was such an amazing, like, little peek into his creative process. He really understood when he had an idea or when the idea came to him. If I don't act on it, I'm going to lose it. So I always like asking writers, what do you do to get into the creative flow and how to tap into that well of creativity that is yours, that you get that muse, if you will, to tap into that?
I mean, that's a very interesting question, because like I want to answer it in at least a couple of different ways. And this is maybe my like Libra quality. You know, my wife's complaint about me is that the answer to every question that she asks me is, well, yes and no. You know, and so there's a part of me that wants to say, actually, no, you don't have a choice. There's nothing I do. It does me, you know, right. That like I will just have to come downstairs at 12:30 at night because I can't sleep. And I know I have to write it down so that I can sleep, you know, because otherwise, you know, the idea is just going to keep kind of going, hey. What do you think? Think about me, you know. So there's that. You know, having said that, I will also say, obviously, there are, you know, I mean, like I, you know, spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to work Pandora to find to curate for myself a collection of music that would be only so interesting to keep my mind occupied a little.
Mm-hmm.
Not so interesting to distract me.
It's a fine balance.
But interesting enough that when my mind goes, oh, do you want to think about something else? I've already fed it this minimally interesting music.
Okay.
You know,
yeah,
as
yeah.
opposed to if I were writing in silence, I would go, and you know, go do something else. You know, so knowing... You know, knowing something about how your brain works and what your capacity is, you know, I'll arrange various treats for myself. You know, I'm a big believer in, you know, the Anne Lamott's book Bird by Bird, and feeling like, you know, you don't have to do it all at once. Break it down into little chunks, bird by bird. And lo and behold, you write about enough birds and you got an aviary. Right. I don't think that's quite the way she put it, but
brick by brick, a piece of the elephant, a bite of the elephant at the time.
Yeah, exactly. So those are, you know, I certainly have my schemes. Having said that, once I had two kids, I also got really good at writing whenever there was the time, because I used to be a guy who, like, and still am somewhat a guy who, like, I love writing, you know, in the middle of the night when the house is all asleep and I have everything to myself and no distractions and so forth. But being a parent meant I learned to write in, like, the little time from 10:05 to 10:23 a.m. or whatever, you know, being a parent of young kids meant you were signing on to a life of none of your plans going like you thought. And so as a sort of evolutionary survival strategy, I acquired the ability to write when I got the shot.
And it was very much like Stephen King, you know, when he was writing Carrie on a typewriter on his lap in the laundry room, and he was just like, as he's doing laundry, he's just typing away on Carrie, his first novel. And you just do what you got to do. And if it's 5 minutes, it's 5 minutes. If it's 5 hours, it's 5 hours. It's whatever you can. But you just got, I think the key is also just writing. Just write. And all the bad stuff is going to flow out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the world is full of people who want to have written.
Oh, they want the glory, but they don't want to do the work.
Well, maybe not even necessarily glory, but they want that feeling of I have written. And so I am able to, like, look back on it and so forth. But what one needs to acquire is the pleasure and the joy of writing as opposed to having written. And if you don't have that joy of actually writing, then it's going to become an insufferable slog and you're going to very quickly find a way to do something else that might also tangentially involve stuff you forced yourself to write. But the actual process of writing is, I was doing it when I was 6 years old without even knowing why I was doing it, you know.
Right.
It's unfortunate in that way that it's, I am not a musician. I would love to be a musician.
Oh, same here.
I have a musical instrument here that my wife gave me that I took some lessons on. But as much as I love the ideas of music, I don't actually yet. Maybe that'll change. Maybe I keep telling myself, you know. But I don't yet find pleasure in the actual, like, playing, in the actual making of the music. Whereas I do, and always have found pleasure in stringing a mess of words together and seeing what happens, and changing the words and going, wait, maybe in fact a shorter sentence here and so forth, you know, and that is feels like home.
Yeah. And that's another thing that, you know, as creators, we a lot of times want to be at the end of the road and don't enjoy the journey. And it's always about the finished screenplay or the finished movie. But the painful, for many people, it's painful to get to that point. You can't sustain a career that way. You need to enjoy this process. You need to enjoy any process you're doing, because the bulk of the time you're on this planet is in the journey. It is not the one night you win the Oscar. It's the 20 years that you were working towards that process to get to the Oscar, if that's a goal of yours or whatever. But those moments are so short, and you can live in them for a minute and then you're done and you're like, okay, now what?
I feel secure saying, Alex, I'm not going to win an Oscar. That's all right.
You're right. Me too.
That kind of work that gets considered for that. And that is perfectly fine, because I love the work that I am doing.
Right.
If it ended up that way, am I going to turn it down and say,
no, I don't want
Gravenese should have this. No, I'll take it. But
give it to Eric Roth again. Don't give it to me. No, I understand completely. And I think you and I are both in that same category. So it's not bad. It's not bad. It's not, look, most of us are in that category. So it's all good. Now, I have to ask you, you got to work with arguably one of the better, one of the best voices in his generation, I think, for as a writer is M. Night. And, you know, coming out with Sixth Sense and for better or worse, always having to live up to success for the rest of his career.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But he is a brilliant writer, and I'm such an admirer of his because he reinvented himself a few times, because there were moments in his career where Hollywood just wrote him off. He's like, oh, that's the end of that. But he just kept his head down and kept putting out great work. And then he's had this resurgence in the last, you know, 5 or 8 years of just putting out great work. What was it like working, and how did you get involved with M. Night for Devil?
You know, time and again, I find myself saying, well, I was really lucky. And, you know, of course, you know, luck is partly that I kept my head down and kept working. And so, you know, the more work you do, the more luck finds you. But nonetheless, I was approached about Devil by Night. My agent called and said, M. Night Shyamalan wants to meet with you.
And you're like, who this? This is a joke.
well, so he says, what I'm told is he's in a hotel in town. So go to the hotel and he'll come down and meet you. And he was so, so friendly and sweet. It was like amazing, because I remember being in the lobby of this hotel and they say, all right, well, here, you can, call up to his room. And so I'm on this, you know, the hotel phone saying, hi, this is Brian Nelson. I was told to call this number. And I hear this voice saying, hey, buddy, it's Night. And like, all right, we're off to the races. So Night had the way that he framed it to me was he said, you know, I've had two or three ideas that feel like little films that could be fun, but maybe they're ideas that would suffer under the weight of written, produced, and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. They're smaller films, and I've made this deal with this company, Media Rights Capital, that I will produce and supervise writers and directors in this, and we'll make these three films. And I'm not sure they all got made, but I was the first out of the box. And he gave me like a 6-7-8 page treatment for what became Devil, and said, is this something that you would want to write? And I told you earlier about my sort of what I frankly call my mission statement, you know, like, is it about a character who like finds themselves, you know? And I use that as a rubric. So, I mean, look, of course there was a part of me that was like, well, if M. Night Shyamalan asked you, do you want to write something? Of course you say yes. But also, frankly, no. I also had to ask myself, does it fit the mission statement? Because I have found in my life that like, if I try to write things that are not in that zone that I've identified as my zone,
right,
they're not going to go well.
Right.
But Devil totally fit that. And so I was happy to sign up. And I did a number of drafts. I worked a lot in close consultation with the Dowdles, John Eric Dowdle, who directed it, and his producer brother, Drew. We hung out quite a bit, talked about the story from different perspectives, and so it was a very effective collaboration and a film that, you know, again, I'm very lucky that people, you know, come up to me all the time and go, oh my God, I just literally a guy I know last month said to me, I was watching this film and I didn't know you wrote it. And at the end of the credits, I was like, wait, is that Brian Nelson that I know? And, you know, frankly, it might not be, because there turn out to be
a couple.
36 Brian Nelsons on IMDb, of which I am Roman numeral 2.
Hey, high up there.
Because I've been around so damn long. You know, I joined IMDb. I started logging on to IMDb when it was run by a little college in like Louisiana, and there were two. And I was on IMDb 2 because my last name is between M and Z, you know? That's how primitive it was in those days.
Wow.
But there's a lot of Brian Nelsons in the world, as it turns out. But I wrote Devil, and that, my friend was like, I didn't even know. And it still continues to haunt people's nightmares.
It was terrifying. I remember when it came out, I saw it was terrifying. And I remember people just talking about it. Like, did you see Devil? Did you see that? Like, it was a little thing in the air about it.
I have a very good friend who's a very accomplished director, and maybe I won't mention her name because I'm going to talk about this phobia of hers, but like, she called me up and said, I'm so happy for you, but I can't see it because I just got through months of therapy to be able to enter elevators.
Oh my God. So yeah, of course, she would never be able be able to get into an elevator again. Now, you know, working with M. Night, was there a lesson or something that you saw in his working, in his writing process, in his storytelling process, that you kind of, a nugget that you pulled away from working with him?
I mean, you know, Night is a tremendously inspirational figure in terms of like, never be afraid to do the next pass. There's always more to do. You know, you talked a moment ago about people saying, well, they want to like have that finished screenplay. But, you know, there is also a saying that like no work of art is ever finished. It is only abandoned. And, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, I remember hanging with Knight in his study, and he's got all the drafts of everything in his study. There on that shelf are like 19 drafts of Signs. There on that shelf are 12 drafts of Lady in the Water, or whatever it is, and so forth. And you know, he is a demon for work. And that to me, I always find very inspirational, is that because I believe that, you know, I've talked quite a bit already about, you know, that you have to find the pleasure in writing. And that means, of course, absolutely the pleasure in rewriting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I remember Knight saying once, you know, sometimes it's interesting, Brian, you'll do a draft and it's got problems, and then the next draft has like moved it forward so much. And then maybe the next draft will have more problems, but then the next draft moves it again. And it's, yeah, you go through, you know, you go through a sine wave sometimes of finding things in a story. And he was a great companion in those terms.
Now, you've written some very suspenseful stuff in your career. How can you create suspense in a scene? What's some advice you can give writers on how to create suspense within a scene? Not a whole movie, but just within a scene.
So, years ago, I was working with producers at BBC Worldwide, and they asked me to write I wrote a pilot for them that was about the Georgian era in England. And I said, I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, but I'm not like the person you would normally come to about this. Like, I'm like the vampire guy, right? And they said, we don't think of you as the vampire guy. And they said something that I was like, one of the nicest things people have ever said about my writing, because they said, you know, we look at Hard Candy and we look at Devil, and we think, no, Brian writes about two or three people who go into a room, have a conversation, And at the end of their conversation, both their lives are changed. And I was like, if that is what ends up as my epitaph, that will be fine.
That's a great epitaph. Jesus.
You know? And this is part of my training as a stage director, is if something is going to be in front of our eyes, then it needs to earn its keep. And it earns its keep by, in any given scene, something must change. And that change happens as a result of, and I'm going to sound extremely academic here, but each character's active intention. What is each person trying to do to affect the other person and create a change in that other person? And then one of them wins, or maybe they both win. Maybe they both come to, you know, a realization, or their conflict creates a new problem or possibility. Every time, if a character is going to earn their weight in a scene, then they need to show up with a goal and intention, something that they want in that scene, and a plan to get it. And then they change. And that is true of the whole script. The entire script is, how did this person change as a result of the choices and plans that they made? And what sacrifices did they have to make? But it's true of any 5-page scene as well, is when characters leave that scene. If that scene was just about, oh, we want to establish the house, or we want to show how sexy these people are, or whatever it is, then to me, it's not earning its keep yet. That something must, the status quo must have evolved by the end of that scene. And the other, going to your suspense question, ideally, I think every scene ends with a question, that if a scene doesn't have a what will happen next at the end of it, then maybe you need to keep working on that scene. The only scene that shouldn't have a what will happen next is the final scene. And even then, you're usually happier if you still have, the movie ends and you're still wondering, oh, wait, isn't there more? What next?
Right.
And so I'm obsessed with story questions. What do people want and what will happen next?
Now, in your travels, you've written in a few writers' rooms. Couple. The one thing that in schools and in academia and just in general, that's not talked about a whole lot, is the politics of the writers' room. Are there any tips you can give young writers who, if they're lucky enough to get in a writer's room, a couple landmines they should look out for as far as political, the politics of room? And obviously that changes per room and per showrunner, but generally.
You know, I do well in writer's rooms, I think, because I'm there to be part of a team and there to engage. And I'm not precious about my words because I know everything's being rewritten all the time.
Right.
You know, and so I really enjoy rooms because I think partly because of my theatrical background that I, you know, grew up working in stages where, you know, even if you're a one-man show, you're still going to need a stage manager and a lighting designer and a director. And so, you know, and so I really feel at home in collaborative art forms. If I wanted to do it all myself, I would be a novelist or a poet.
Right.
But I don't actually want to do it all myself. I want to work with partners and people whom I can challenge, people who will challenge me, people who we can all make each other better. The more voices, this is partly an exciting time in television because we are bringing out more voices than we ever have in maybe even the history of culture. Mm-hmm. And so that's a thrilling thing. So I, you know, if frankly, it sounds a little simple, but my just advice would be, first of all, just be open-minded and be willing to contribute, and don't be precious about, oh, this is my idea or this is how I wanted to say it, because it's all going to change 7 more times anyway,
right,
later. But the more that you engage in a spirit of not about, oh, what you said versus what I said.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And more about, what does the story want? What do these characters want? As long as you're talking about the stories and characters, then you're getting it out of the realm of ego and into the realm of craft. And that's what I think makes a successful room.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. What was the biggest fear you had to overcome to write the first screenplay, your first screenplay? Because I'm assuming you didn't just go in all guns a blaring. I'm assuming there was some, hey, can I do this? Or, you know, things like that.
You know, I've been around a long time, so now you're asking me to cast my mind back across the decades. It sounds very simple, but probably the biggest fear I had was, am I wasting my time? Is this something that I could be good at?
Right.
You know, and I gave myself a certain, like, clock by which I needed to see some signs of success, or I would decide, you know, don't knock on a door that nobody's up on the other side of, you know. And luckily for me, someone knocked pretty early before that, because I didn't give myself, frankly, the longest time frame for that. Mm-hmm.
What was the time frame, you know, by the way? Was it like a couple of years, 2-3 years?
Oh, no, no, no. Much shorter than that.
Oh,
no.
Really?
No.
What was your time frame?
I had written, I mean, effectively, maybe it should turn out to be a couple of years, but I didn't think of it that way. I was directing plays. I was making money on the side, writing script coverage. I was also working a day job while my wife was in grad school. So I didn't have a ton of time. I wrote 2 episodic specs, samples. Like back in those days, you wrote samples of shows that were on the air.
Sure, sure.
I sent them to agents. People were like, this is nice. Thank you. Send in what, send us what else, everybody else you write. I'm like, okay, I got to do some more. I wrote a spec movie of the week, same reaction. And so then I was like, well, I'm going to write a screenplay, and I'm going to write the best damn screenplay I can imagine writing. And I'm not going to think about whether it's commercial or whatever I should, you know, people were like saying, but could you write Under Siege 2? Shouldn't you think of that? And, you know, no, I'm going to write the best possible thing I can write. And if it goes somewhere, then it goes somewhere. And if it doesn't, that will be that. Then that will be that. And I will focus on where people seem to be interested in my episode.
So you,
and
so
luckily you... for me, that script, without my even hardly trying, got response. Through theater, I had a friend who worked in script development. His day job at night, he was working in theater like me, but his day job was he worked in MOWs for a studio. And I asked him, just as a pal, could you give me notes on this to try to help me get an agent? You know, I'm not submitting it to you, my
right.
friend.
Yeah.
Just please, I would benefit of your wisdom, any notes you could give me. And then timidly, like 2 or 3 weeks later, I poked my head in his door and I was like, I don't mind if you have it. And Eddie said, yeah, no, I have no notes. I think it's great. I think we should buy it. Well, they didn't buy it, but he then got it to a producer who actually optioned it and got me an agent out of it. And suddenly I was like, well, I guess I can do this. And I guess I shall persevere.
So the advice you're giving screenwriters is give yourself 12 months, write one screenplay. That's it.
Horrible advice.
And if it doesn't work out, then go do something else. That's basically what you're saying.
No, all I could do is report my journey.
Of course. No, of course.
I have many friends who have worked in this for years, and it is their dream to write movies. I, as I think I told you way along, was like, there could be a lot of things I do. Maybe I'll be a sociologist. You know, I mean, that was actually something I considered for a bit. You know, I love telling stories, but I was also prepared for this not to work out.
That's awesome.
So again, lucky for me, because it did.
But the thing is, you've spoken about luck a bunch in this conversation, but the thing is that you created your luck because you actually did the work. It's not like someone knocked on your door and like, hey, man, do you got any ideas? Hey, I'll pay you to write a script. No, that's not the way it was. You put in the labor and then luck happened.
Sure. So now I will tell you, I've told you my unified field theory of what I write. Now I'll tell you my unified field theory of careers.
Okay.
So
please.
Back in those days, I was watching and going, why are those people who are so brilliant, but they are not getting, their careers are not moving forward. And meanwhile, some other people who frankly, I don't think are so brilliant, but they are working like hell. What's that about? And so I devised this theory where you have to imagine a triangle. And each of the points of this triangle is a different aspect that might help you get a career. But the secret is you don't need all three. Your career is a line that connects the two. You only need two of them to have a career. So the three points are talent, perseverance, and luck. So you might have no talent, but if you persevere and you are lucky, you will have a career.
Right.
You might have no perseverance.
Like writing one script.
Well,
no, you be.
But yes, but if you have talent and you are lucky, you will have a career. And then we all know people who have no luck at all, but they have talent and they never quit.
Right. And they built something out for themselves.
And I constructed this theory at about the same time that I was writing that script. So maybe I've always been trying to talk myself into persevering. Now, you know, that's not fair.
No, that's not fair because you've done a lot, sir.
I work a lot.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. But the corollary to this triangle is my talent is what it is. I could improve on, I can study craft. I read other people's scripts all the time. I like watching bad movies because it's like, oh, what can I learn from this? How did this go awry? But at the same time, to a certain extent, your eye is your eye. You got a little bit what you got through the vagaries of fate and genetics or whatever else. I don't know. Your talent is somewhat of a fixed quantity. Your luck, you have no control at all. That's why it's called luck. So really the only thing you can control is your perseverance.
Absolutely.
And so that is my actual advice to people, Alex Ferrari, is persevere.
Or possibly that, even hustle.
Imagine what a turner. Yeah. Yeah, you might. You might. No, it's true. Because look, that whole anecdote about that screenplay is, on the other hand, in the context of, but I've been working, you know, since high school in the arts, and I've been like acting, directing, playwriting.
You were honing. You were honing your craft.
I guess I don't ever think of it as honing my craft. That sounds so kind of.
Well, no, but but you were telling stories. You were working in the arts, so you were gathering things left and right.
I'm pursuing the story. I was in graduate school at UCLA, and there was a professor named Michael Gordon who had had this amazing career. He had worked with the group theater. Then he had directed the film of Cyrano de Bergerac, okay?
Which one?
With Jose Ferrer.
Yeah.
And then he got blacklisted. Didn't hardly work through the 50s. When he came back, he managed to direct again, but not Cyrano de Bergerac. His comeback film was Pillow Talk with Rock Hudson and Doris Day. But he took that job and made the most of it, right, and continued working for years and years. And so he was a guy who just managed to build his career out of what is the story? What will make people want to wonder what happens next? And I looked at the plays that I had directed and the ones that had worked and the ones that had not worked. And I was like, oh, duh. The ones that work are the ones about story, the ones that made people wonder what would happen next.
Right.
The ones that were just about a theme or an idea. Yeah, maybe there's people who can make pieces about theme or about spectacle.
Right.
Work without story. There's people who do that.
Oh, and I won't say their names out loud, but yes, there's
and more power built, to them.
Built
more
careers them. Upon them.
I would never harsh anyone else's jam.
Absolutely.
But what makes my work is story and character. And I realized I could be intellectually tempted to work on a piece that's just about like the fascination of language or whatever. But no, those pieces are going to be only interesting to me.
Fair enough.
You know, and so that's what I learned. And so maybe I'll revise my screenwriting origin story to give myself a little more credit.
You should. I think a little bit more credit. I mean, though, because it's not like you just like you were working fries at a Burger King and all of a sudden like, I'm going to give myself 12 months and one script to write, and I haven't barely written anything in my life. That's not what you said. You've been working hard to get to that place.
No, that's true. No, it's totally fair. In fact, even the day job actually was I got a job in a studio legal department.
Right.
So I was, in fact, watching the business of how you movies are put together. I was like,
honing your
Travolta get to fly his own plane to the set? Why does that matter? Interesting. Okay. You know, so.
Oh, that's a whole other episode. Just what you learned during that time in your life, all the inside stuff of those deals. I have two more questions for you. One, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
The lesson is make sure that Alex asks me in the second question about Agent Stoker, which I'm dying to talk more about.
Okay.
Okay. Now ask me that question again, because that's all I can think of for a moment. Go ahead.
Well, tell me about Agent Stoker first.
I mean, bless your heart. You're so kind.
I've heard this thing about Agent Stoker. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Why did you ask that? So look, this is this has been such a fascinating, fun journey for me. I met Chris Connor through Altered Carbon, where he played Poe. our AI, who believed he was Edgar Allan Poe. He crushed that role. Shortly into the pandemic shutdown, he was like, hey, since nobody can like shoot anything, what if we like created a podcast? I have like this feeling that like, I keep thinking, is there a way to do Black Mirror meets the old radio plays of The Shadow?
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, you know, if someone worked in a lab and tried to figure out the phrase to fastest penetrate into my cerebral cortex, I don't think they could do better. Like,
Right. Yeah.
I can write that.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And so what we cooked up was this scripted supernatural podcast, call it a paranormal thriller. It is called Agent Stoker. And we have various log lines for it. One is, of course, Black Mirror meets The Shadow. Another is part Raymond Chandler, part Philip K. Dick, and all macabre all the time.
Oh, sounds amazing.
Another log line for it is The X-Files with a drinking problem.
what a great image. That's amazing.
Agent Stoker works for a covert organization called the Night Brigade that is tracking incidents that have no explanation, but maybe the explanation, if we can all hook them up, is that the end of the world is coming, and maybe we should try to get ahead of that.
Just maybe.
But Agent Stoker is facing the loss of his partner and is not really necessarily sure he is up to the job. He is, you might say, thrown into a gray zone where the rules are not clear, right?
I've heard that before. I've heard of that before.
And it's where it's up to him to figure out how to persevere. But perseverance in his case also requires in every episode the examination of some artisanal cocktail.
Obviously.
Which is one of the Easter eggs that we put into every episode. We also managed to put into every episode a little bit of baseball trivia. We also managed to put into every episode an actual real world indie bookstore that we are doing a pro bono shout out to.
Oh, that's amazing.
And yet in every episode, he also deals with schizophrenic AI and sentient mold and demon werecats and a number of, terrifying
phenomena that fall
into another one of our log lines for the show, which is think of it as CSI apocalypse. So we cooked up this show. We approached wonderful actors who are not household names, but who you know through, you know, being fans of television and so forth, who've been a bunch of people from Altered Carbon, Amy Hill from Magnum PI, our biggest name probably is our announcer and later the voice of the Night Brigade is Emily Deschanel. But also Peter Jason from Deadwood.
Do you do a voice?
I do not do a voice.
No, actually,
because we thought, you know what, we're going to do this exactly like we would if it were not the shutdown and we were doing it for live TV. So all the actors are being paid SAG minimums and Chris and I created Night Brigade LLC as a SAG signatory. And it's funny. One of my high school friends just wrote me and said, aren't you doing a voice in this? And I, actually, I I love all of the voices in this coming from the universe of actors that Chris and I know and love that we've just always been dying to do something more with.
That's great.
And we brought in actually, you know, directors that we love too. So the pilot and the finale are directed by Rachel Talalay from Doctor Who and Sherlock and Superman and Lois. Several episodes are directed by Oz Scott, who's done everything from For Colored Girls to SWAT. MJ Bassett, whom I met on Da Vinci's Demons and Night Flyers and also did Altered Carbon, does a block of three episodes. So that's we've been great. Having a hell of a time. Our sound design is by our co-producer, Patrick Hogan, who currently does sound for little things like Cobra Kai and so forth. Our line producer is an amazing woman named Dana Brower, who I met on Night Flyers. Music, we have a theme music by an indie composer we know named Christy Carew. We have end title music by Portland indie band, the Parson Redheads. I mean,
it sounds
we have
awesome.
A lot of elements here. You should listen. I rather.
Where can people listen to it?
Wherever you get your podcasts.
And what's the name of the show again, once again?
Is Agent Stoker.
Okay, so everyone listening, I'll have
a story that you can find on Spotify or Apple or you name it. It's out there, and you better find it before it finds you.
I will put it on. I will put it on the show notes. One last question. Three screenplays every screenwriter should read.
Oh, you should have warned me, because, you know, this is the sort of thing that, like, there's certain questions that when people ask them, of course, the things that you think go out of your head.
Right.
You know, I literally keep a post-it here so that when people say, what have you been watching lately? I have the answer so that I'll remember. Because otherwise, you know, you go, right, I've been watching things. What are they? So look, you talked earlier about Knight. Knight's screenplay for Unbreakable is incredible to me. I remember reading it back when I was starting out, and I've like saved it. I've still got my copy. You know, it's. I would recommend that to anyone. This might be an unexpected answer, but when I think over the years of like pilots that I've read and blown me away, that you know, there have been shows that there have been pilots that I might recommend, but I also, when I think about screenplays, I'm gonna toss in The Third Man. I love The Third Man. I think about that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
A screenplay that I might not recommend, except I love it. It's structurally a mess,
but it works.
Best movie ever made, maybe, is The Big Sleep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I was hired on Altered Carbon in part because I came into the meeting and I said, you know, this story is like The Big Sleep. And Lita Calagritis was like, yes, it is. I'm so happy you know that. You know, so I think about The Big Sleep all the time. I'm not stopping at three. Dirty Pretty Things is an amazing script to me. You know, it is exactly what I've talked about. It is a guy thrown into a place where the rules are not clear, and now he has to ask himself, what am I capable of to face this? I am a giant fan of Days of Heaven, the Terrence Malick film.
Yeah, I mean, that's a masterpiece.
I'm a big fan of Mean Creek.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think is a very under-discussed film. But again, a film where people discover what they are capable of that they never wanted to know about themselves. That's five.
I think you're good. You're good. No, you're good. We could keep going forever. I mean, we could do the podcast of just like scripts you should read. And we just do like 20 every episode.
Fair enough.
But no, that was excellent. Brian, I know we could keep talking for another few hours, but I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on the show and dropping your knowledge bombs on our tribe. So I truly appreciate it, my friend. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Great to talk. And I will see you again when you least expect it.
I want to thank Brian so much for coming on the show, dropping his knowledge bombs, and making me laugh a whole bunch during our conversation. Thank you so much, Brian. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to listen to his new podcast, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/573. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe to the show, and leave a good review. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.